Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer, and got Dr. Carl, my brother, super endocrinologist, the greatest endocrinologist in the world, unless we have another endocrinologist on the podcast. And it becomes a second. Today, we are going to talk about some protein, and we're going to do that at some point here. We don't know where Stuart Phillips went. We're just going to throw him under the bus. I think there was a mistake. There was a calendar something, and he may actually pop in while we're doing this other podcast. But my brother and I were discussing before this about we'd like to go over some case, case studies, case reports. And so my brother doesn't know this one. This is a patient I saw, I'm going to say recently, because HIPAA, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to say the exact age. Woman in her 30s and 40s. So I'm going to give this case and kind of see where it goes.
But do we need to talk about the elephant in the room?
If anybody's no, the thing is, people this, are listening to. No, if you're okay, watching this on YouTube, I have
Spencer shaved his head and I died laughing before when we got on
it. Skin tight. It's
close enough.
Close. It's a close. It's like a maybe a yeah. I don't know. It's.
I haven't seen him look like that since 1987.
Similar in college, and people, coach was like, oh, I think you look, it makes your neck look bigger and whatever. I didn't like it because it was too close. But then it my hair grows back very fast.
Weird, because now your neck's kind of like a pencil.
I know. It's because nobody's hanging on my head, and I don't, so maybe I should do the, we don't have a neck machine. Anyway, let's go over this case. Oh, okay. I can do bridges, I suppose.
Yeah, something.
But maybe I'll get sleep apnea again. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to do this case. Let's see what you, I want to hear what you think. You haven't heard of the case yet. All right, listen.
Lady in her 30s. Okay.
Lady in her 30s to 40s, let's say. Okay. She sent me a text message that said, Dr. Spencer, can tirzepatide cause numbness in your leg at all? And I was like, what? It's just in one leg? And she was like, yeah, just like a little bit of numbness in my like lower leg. And I was like, I go, well, potentially nutrient deficiencies. Potentially, what we think about with neuropathies, we think of like B12 deficiencies.
Yeah.
And she said,
now wait, why is she on it? Does she have type 2 diabetes?
Yeah, patient has a history of obesity, has lost a considerable amount of weight. Let's call it a quarter of her weight, 25% of her weight, now down into the 100s from like 200 or so. And I'm spitballing, so it's not exactly that. So nobody can pinpoint who this person is.
Well, yeah.
So she's lost a lot of weight.
But just to be, because you talked about B12 deficiency, and so you know people are maybe familiar with metformin increases risk of B12 deficiency. So we check a B12 every year in people with diabetes who are on metformin. But that's not the case, is that right?
And so if you're just not eating as much for some reason, you're going on a vegan type of diet, but like that would be bilateral. So I was like, no, I don't know. You should probably get it checked out though. Maybe something else is going on. Usually one side, it's musculoskeletal something there. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, like a week later, I get a message. Hey, I'm having some like real weakness in that foot. Oh, I swear.
Was she having foot drop?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And she's like, is this related? And I was like, wait a second. Okay. Tell me a little bit more. She was basically having foot drop.
How fast was her weight loss? Was it pretty substantial?
Hold on.
Well, just off the top of your head, but God,
it was not, she had a lot of weight loss, but it wasn't like, mm-hmm. It wasn't extremely fast. It was how I'd usually do it, like the standard, half a percent to 1%. Per week type of thing. But like, why all of a sudden? Well, do you have any ideas of why this would be caused?
So I'll tell you, because we know these studies very well. Obviously, I just published the algorithm guideline for it. And I don't recall these types of things being statistically enough to like even be in the publication and something that's of concern. However, I'm pretty sure that any substantial weight loss can, you know, lead to essentially like a foot drop or some type of one type of neuron or neuropathy type of issue. In this case, is it the perineal nerve? I'm not an neurologist anymore.
Yeah, no,
but anyways,
fibular perineal.
So in this case, that sounds like what it would be from, not the medication specifically though, that I do. That, because I don't know how that mechanism would work, but just weight loss in general for because I think I think bariatric surgery, I've heard about that more maybe. Is that
so? Okay. So she was like, have you seen this before? I was like, no, I haven't seen this. And I was thinking about back to, I'd have shin splints and I'd have to ice and I'd have to tie a bag of ice during wrestling and football to my sides of my legs, and they'd always be like, you got to be careful because you get foot drop if you put a lot of pressure on that outside, the lateral aspect of your knee, right below your knee is right where the your fibula is, your fibular head, and the peroneal nerve, the fibular nerve goes right there. So what could somebody be doing once they lose a lot of weight that would put pressure on that one side outside of their knee? What is something that they couldn't do before that all of a sudden that they'd be doing now more often that would put pressure on that?
Is this something?
No, just think about just everyday things that, like, okay, if you're sitting down, normally you kind of sit.
Crossing your legs.
Yeah, crossing legs.
Yeah, absolutely. That's sure.
So I was looking into this more and I was like, okay, yes, you do see it in more in bariatric surgery, but it's called Slimmer's paralysis.
Yeah.
I'd never personally seen this.
No,
I was looking into this.
I don't think I have. It just, I've heard it make some sense, right?
I was like, man, this has got it. We got to write this up. So then I started looking. I was like, nobody's written this up as a case report. Somebody wrote it up last year. Someone had a case of Slimmer's paralysis from tirzepatide. And I was like, are you crossing your legs more? She's like, yeah, of course. I can. It was like a non-scale victory. I can cross my legs more.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God. But I was actually really nervous because, like, you got to be very careful. If you don't intervene, you can become permanent. So I was like, please get in to see the doctor in person, because I'm doing this all telemedicine. And she did. And luckily her doctor is a sports medicine doctor who agreed that was the diagnosis. And the foot drop went away. The numbness is still there and is recovering. But this was recent, and I was a bit like, oh my God, what the heck? But just like you, I was like, why would this person have? No, it's not the tirzepatide, because that would be bilateral if it was like a nutrient deficiency. Yeah. But when people lose weight, and so I was looking more into it, because again, I've never seen this before. The fat surrounding it usually protects the nerve, so if you don't have that there protecting anymore, it can become more compressed, which you think is opposite because you have less tissue there, but now it usually protects it. So then it can become more compressed, and then you start crossing your legs more. Boom. Yeah. It's not super common, but it's common enough to have its own name called Slimmer's paralysis.
Yeah. Yeah. I was waiting for you to tell me some sort of crazy inappropriate story that had happened in some sort of fornication or something like that. But
well, I'd hope not with, if any of my patients, that would be extremely unethical, Dr. Carl. Are you saying?
I thought
not that's me you're first. Right. You're saying with the patient and someone else. Yeah, that. Well,
actually, yeah, no, not you, what? You're not you, asshole.
I don't know. You said some crazy story with fornication.
No, no.
Not me.
No.
Jeez. No. I will say, actually, on that same note, something that maybe people, since we're kind of talking about case studies, you see it not. I don't want to say it's like rare, but it's not. It's not common, but it's not super uncommon. And I'm sure you've seen this as well. People lose a lot of weight, and we should probably have a relationship specialist on here talking about this. I've seen some interesting things where people start developing because they have so much more confidence, and their partner may not have joined in on the journey with them. And they may not be getting as much, they may be getting more attention from elsewhere. And I've seen it to where, and this is like an important topic. Again, you and I sure as hell shouldn't be talking about relationship stuff.
Good Lord. No, on our advice. That will be a bad move on your part.
You just don't want our advice.
No. We're pretty and to be clear, our wives don't even listen to this because of how much our advice is bad for these types of tips.
We're pretty good husbands, I think, but like
we're the greatest husbands, but they don't necessarily always
we are the best.
Yeah.
But we should get somebody on here because there's probably people with a lot more like relationship counselors.
Oh, yeah.
We should probably put out the call. I'm maybe doing this. Somebody shoot us an email if you've helped people through this before. But I've seen this before where people start having affairs from being on the medicine, not from the medicine itself, but from losing weight, getting attention. Yeah. It's just something they haven't had in decades, maybe.
Yeah. And I think, again, kind of going back to the, where there's a little bit more experience with this, I think in the surgical realm too, where people have, undergone bariatric surgery and done really well and had these issues. Now, I suppose that could also bring up, I don't know if we've talked a lot on the podcast about this because it's a little bit a newer thing. You know, we've talked a lot about some of these subtle little side effects of, say, the GLP therapies. We're talking about this right now. And you've talked a lot about the subtle anhedonia. But
yeah.
There have been some more reports of, essentially lower libido is what we would call it.
I think it's all on the same spectrum.
Because you think about all these different, hormones in the brain that where these are working on, and that kind of the hedonic, mm-hmm. nature of hunger. That's a little bit different than, say, the actual hunger mechanisms. But, it makes some sense. So I think people do have to be careful. And I think, I've seen or heard of people being able to reduce the doses a little bit and doing a little bit better like that. I'm sure we'll get more publications and more research on that. But something to be aware of.
Yeah. Now that I've been talking about the anhedonia thing, so many people are coming in going, yes, that's me. I'm lacking motivation to whatever, go work out. But then the libido thing comes up, and we had Dr. Susan Davis on here, and a lot of people want testosterone, and sometimes it's reducing their dose of Zepbound. Cause they think, I got to get some testosterone. And I'm like, okay, you do a good history taking. Was the libido issue before or after the Zepbound? It was after the Zepbound. Okay. Yeah. And they're already on hormonal replacement therapy. And then you drop their dose from I see it mostly at 15.
Yes, I was just going to say, and I feel like this is where, the studies do sort of support more of these real subtle little side effects.
Yeah.
It seems like it's at the 15 of tirzepatide, maybe the 2-4 of semaglutide, and going down a little bit seems to do a little bit better. I mean, remember in the tirzepatide trials, there was a little bit more, dropout of the trials at the 15 compared to say the 10 and the 5. It's subtle, but it's there. There's definitely the signal of all these little things.
And you've gone over the data before, but like with SURMOUNT, I always say like, look, the 15 gets another percent or two more of total body weight loss compared to the 10. And what I've seen too is that people lose more weight. Like once they get to the max, they weren't losing weight, so we got them to the max. We bring them down back to 10. They start losing more weight because now they feel more motivated to work out. It's really, really weird.
It'll be interesting to see if that can be splayed out in the studies going forward. And especially, there is going to be the tirzepatide maintenance trial ongoing that at lower doses, which will be very helpful for all sorts of reasons. These reasons, cost effectiveness, side effect reduction, et cetera. So, hopefully a lot more in the future to come. What's interesting is that also talking about libido in males who are suffering from obesity, especially sleep apnea, diabetes, they get the male obesity associated hypogonadism. So literal actual low testosterone. Now we can debate on whether they should get testosterone or not, depending on if they want to be on those meds forever or whatever. But we do know that, bariatric surgery, tirzepatide, semaglutide, et cetera, help lose the weight. And then they have a return of function of their hypothalamus, pituitary, testicular function, and their libidos generally go up as you would expect with more functional testosterone. But certainly I feel like, it can work against itself at the highest doses, lose too much weight. We've talked about, dramatic weight loss can certainly, cause a little bit of that sort of issue too. I mean,
it across
the board, like a hypothalamic amenorrhea.
Yeah. This deficiency syndrome.
Yeah, all those things. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've seen it So most guys feel better. I've seen it again at the highest doses once in a while. And now, and before I wasn't asking about it because people are like, I'm feeling good. Can I just have my refill? I'm like, are you sure everything's good? Now when they've been on the 15 for like whatever, 6 months or so, I'm like, are you sure you're feeling good? Any motivation? Like now that you mention it, I haven't been doing my whatever classes anymore. I haven't been doing my, it's some sort of hobby. And sometimes I add bupropion. I try to adjust the dose. Sometimes bupropion helps, because it's a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor. So basically there's more dopamine, to do its thing. We're going to get a neurobiologist on here. Our buddy's, Zach, who's a neurobiologist.
I thought you were going to say Huberman.
Huberman. We might, Andrew Huberman, he and I were messaging and I doubt he would come on our podcast, but we're going to try. We want to
redeem himself.
We wanted to rough him up a little bit with in jest. We would never be not like when we were on the Jillian Michaels and she was like kind of mean to us. And I tried to joke back and she did not even crack a smile. And I was like, jeez, I was like, why? This is a good joke. I mean, maybe it wasn't good, but I don't know.
She hates
it. It was okay. It was all right. Okay. Other case studies. Do you have any case studies that are kind of interesting recently?
Well, in my world, November was Diabetes Awareness Month. So we did a lot of diabetes stuff, here, and I, did some advocacy. That was why Miranda from Wood TV8, who everyone knew around here growing up, little diabetes awareness thing. So something, I do like to talk about, I don't know how much we've gotten this in here, is people think of historically type 1 diabetes being youth and type 2 diabetes being adult onset, weight related, et cetera. But there's no rule that says you can't have both. And anybody can develop type 1 diabetes at any age, technically. That's the autoimmune destruction of your pancreas.
I'm waiting for mine. I'm going to be pissed if I get it. Well, I have a couple autoimmune things.
Yeah, you do have a high risk also of a true adrenal insufficiency, but that's a different day. But I think it's important for people to know that people with type 1 diabetes can, struggle certainly with weight. And in fact, I think statistically, the prevalence of obesity is the same in people with type 1 diabetes as it is in the general population, which also means they can develop the same type of insulin resistant pathology and essentially a type 2 sort of diabetes physiology requiring high amounts of insulin. And people with type 1 diabetes have been using these types of medications. They've been studied in type 1 diabetes in general. They haven't been approved for type 1 diabetes yet, but they have been shown to be very helpful for just kind of stabilizing blood sugar control. As you can imagine, slowing the gastric emptying, helping with diet, helping with the the liver sugar, et cetera. I'm kind of surprised they haven't been approved for type 1 diabetes, but people with type 1 diabetes and obesity do very, very well on GLP-1 receptor agonists, semaglutide, tirzepatide. And I actually, my team a year or two ago tried to submit a case series for it. I guess we didn't do a very good job of writing it up because it got denied. But then since then, I have seen others though publish several case series. Yeah. So this is not just like a one-off where a few like random cowboy endocrinologists are doing it.
There was a trial with semaglutide, right? Not tirzepatide yet, maybe.
So that's the thing. These are now being published. And so I think it's important for people with type 1 diabetes struggling with obesity and really high requirements of insulin to talk to their endocrinologists about. And these are, very, very helpful therapies in people with, insulin resistance and type 1 diabetes as well.
I have like maybe 5 patients in that scenario. And what we had to do is basically, it sounds terrible and hopefully insurances aren't listening, but we had to basically say, well, they have type 2 diabetes. And they're like, no, they have type 1. I'm like, yeah, but they also have type 2. And
this is big insurance being assholes because that's the thing. So there is no rule that says you can't have essentially type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So we have a lot of
patients. How would you diagnose that? How would you prove it?
Well, so it kind of depends on what came first. So a lot of people are diagnosed with, you know, obesity, type 2 diabetes at some point, and then suddenly things just don't seem right. Like they should be doing better, but they suddenly require insulin. And, you know, we can check into type 1 diabetes antibodies, essentially. And then we can check their pancreatic insulin secretion ability with something called a C-peptide and essentially prove that they now have developed type 1 diabetes. And we always knew, like, I mean, going way back, that people with type 2 diabetes who happen to have any of those antibodies had a much more, future of requiring insulin, even back in the day.
What if they had type 1 first, though?
So that's just purely, it's sort of a clinical thing. So if someone has type 1 right. diabetes and they're gaining weight, you know, let's say in adulthood, just like anybody does in society these days through a complex, you know, biology working against them. And they have that extra little monkey wrench thrown in there of the type 1 diabetes that they have to manage. They're the ones that have to give themselves the insulin, count their carbs, all these other things. And then they just tend to start requiring a higher and higher and higher amount of insulin, thus right. very literally sort of showing you an insulin resistant sort of pattern. And so, because there's not, I mean, they already have the diagnosis of diabetes and that has to do with blood sugar levels.
Yeah. Is there a formal way to go like, okay, this person now needs however many units of insulin compared to what it was? Like that should be your project.
God. Okay. Well,
how about you get somebody that knows how to write something up and put your name on it?
Oh, you know what? You know who we should have to talk about that?
Tim Zagurski?
Oh, Garvey? Yeah, maybe we get both of them. Yeah, that would be a good Garvey. Combination. That would
yeah, let's power. Get them on.
Yeah.
Because like, so basically, that's how I said it in the clinical documentation. I was like, this person, I can't remember, because their insurance was not. They're like, nope, they're on a pump. Yeah. And I was like, clearly, this person has obesity, and they have insulin resistance. Their requirements of insulin are so much higher now. And we convinced them.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's good. I mean, that's what a lot of people do. The other things you can do to help would be like, say, do they have a dyslipidemia, high triglycerides, low yeah. HDL, that's consistent with type 2 diabetes? Do they have hypertension, which, you know, a lot of people have, but specifically weight-related hypertension, et cetera. So, yeah.
Here are a couple more cases that we, you know, do you know about like the post-hypoglycemic hypoglycemia you get from post-bariatric surgery?
Oh, yeah. We do a ton of that stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it looks like tirzepatide, maybe some semaglutide, tirzepatide seems to help with this.
Yes, now, it does. Yeah. Okay. I can tell. I can tell.
Yeah. So I have a couple patients now with this, and they found massive improvements. There's some case reports and some. So why don't you talk about that or anybody that has this?
Yeah, this is now essentially kind of recommended in the endocrine surgical realm. So people who have especially Roux-en-Y gastric bypasses, they tend to have this the most, where, you know, you're darn near essentially bypassing so much that the gut, and they have improved, by the way, ironically, GLP and incretins and whatnot, but it's such a rapid digestion and increase in the blood glucose. But then I always tell patients, it's like the system now is working, and then you have this drop, you know, the pancreas is working, it's working too hard, and you have similar to reactive hypoglycemia in insulin resistant people, but more dramatic, and it can be very distressful and actually more symptomatic in these people post gastric bypass. And so the first line is always dietary strategy. So, you know, lower carbs, higher fiber, quality protein, good quality fats to kind of smooth out that glycemia. You know, we always talk about how most people don't need to worry if their sugar spikes up a little bit and then goes back down, like people, you know, the low carb zealots out there try to say. But in these patients, you really do need to do that to help avoid that that post bariatric surgery hypoglycemia. And so we have a variety of other medical therapies we do. So something called acarbose, which you and I know very well, but this is a medicine that's been around for type 2 diabetes for a long time that essentially blocks the enzyme breakdown of starches and carbohydrates. And so you can take that before meals that have carbs in them. And so you don't get as much digestion, thus you slow down the blood glucose spike. And that helps with bariatric surgery, hypoglycemia. There's some other medications that work directly on the pancreas, like diazoxide, that reduces the amount of insulin going along with it. There are even surgical procedures to help with this. But the this has been known now for a while. I mean, because I feel like in the endocrine world, we've been talking about this probably for 10 or more years about how these GLP-1 type therapies, and it mostly is because it slows everything down. It's also working on that glucagon and the glycemia in the liver, and it slows down the digestion, the gastric emptying, and so you don't have these spikes. And I think, like you said, you use the term paradoxical, which means it's not exactly what we all expected,
right?
Because these medications are so good at improving blood sugars, lowering blood sugars, that you know, you might think at surface value that, this would make that worse. But actually, you're right. Paradoxically, it is pretty well established now that these help smooth everything out. They help smooth the glycemia, just like in type 1 diabetes, just like in type 2 diabetes, and in reactive or post-bariatric surgery glycemia, where it just kind of slows the whole process down, smooths out the glycemia, and really is probably turned into darn near first line for those patients, I would think.
Yeah. So the CGM is so interesting because they'll come to me and they'll be like, my CGM, just from eating a small little piece of carbohydrate, something, it'll jump up to like 300. And I'm like, boom. Then they go down to 40 and they feel they're like about to crash out.
Yep.
And we start just a little baby dose, a little 2.5 of Zepbound or Mounjaro, whatever we can get. And all of a sudden they're like, oh, and it's only going up to like the 140s and now goes down to like the 80s or something, like kind of normal.
Yeah.
Perfect. And it's so interesting. And I was, you know, I saw a few case reports about this as well. And it's thought maybe because the incretin response from the gastric bypass is too elevated. And so this kind of, again, smooths it out or makes it more constant. I'm not sure. I would think it was more the gastric emptying effect of it, but I could be wrong about that.
Especially, I think that's a lot of it.
Yeah, I'm not really sure, but it's certainly smoothed things out, and they feel just so much better. And of course, a lot of people with post-bariatric surgery, they're still having a lot of the food noise that wasn't resolved from the surgery. So just a little shtickle of Zepbound does the trick. Kind of interesting. I think those are some good case studies people can. I'm sure people will talk about these because these are, we're going to get a urologist on. I've noted some weird stuff with people feeling like they have UTIs. We talked about this before. I was like, is this constipation? What is this pushing on the bladder? No, it's something about the GLP-1s changing the tone or something of the bladder. So we got to get the urologist that's studying this, because I started using hyoscyamine, or it's an antispasmodic, and that, like, these people will go in feeling like they're having UTIs and it's clean, their urine's clean, and there's nothing different other than they're on Zepbound or semaglutide or Wegovy, and they just keep getting urine cultures, put on antibiotics. It's like, and it's not helping. So then they stop the medicine and it helps, but I'm like, that's, they shouldn't have to do that. So then some patients use like mannose. I don't know why that would help, but like hyoscyamine, antispasmodic. I don't know. So there's a urologist that was noticing it, and they're doing studies on bladder tone and function. There's something that has to do some just weird stuff that you don't see that often, but you go onto Reddit, you'll see people talk about it too. So it's common enough to where it, there's enough people, like, it's not just one off that's could have been a placebo by chance. There's something, some sort of signal there. So, all right, I think that's it. We're going to, I don't know what happened to our protein discussion, but we'll make that for another. Stu left. Stuart Phillips. We had him on the podcast before. We're going to have him on again to do this. Basically going over a lot of we're meatheads. We eat a lot of protein, but like sometimes it's overhyped. And it's
overhyped.
It's like a frosting as opposed to like the true meat of it, the true cake. Nope, although some people like the frosting better than the cake, so I don't know.
Pun intended. All right.
Cherry on top would be the creatine. We should get a creatine specialist on. There's a lot of
That's a great thing. So I talk about this all the time, by the way. So everyone's talking about creatine for people with GLPs. Well, we don't have exactly any data for that, but the strength training, the resistance training, we've gone over this over and over ad nauseum. That is the most important stimulus of muscle maintenance and growth. Then the protein, But even then, it's not as important as the strength training. And then maybe, you know, if you're doing all those other things to get a little bit of extra benefit, some creatine reasonably, but just get the basic stuff and don't buy the pink stuff that they're trying to market inappropriately to females.
Yeah. It's they're going to
basic.
They're going to double charge you. Get just standard good, good brands that are respectable here. So, all right. Anybody have that has, would find some of these case reports, case studies interesting? Oh, go, if you haven't reviewed us yet, go give us a good 5-star. If you're not going to give us a good review, please
stop that.
But it helps get the podcast out there. We every time we go to these conferences, we hear that there's new biotechs, you know, GLP-1. There's a ton of people trying to jump in the game. CEOs have come up to me going, "Oh, we listen to your podcast." I'm like, "Oh God,
We're gonna try to get the Lilly CEO on.
Oh yeah, we gotta get David Ricks on. He's not listening to this, but someone from Lilly is, send it up the chain. Let's get you on. We saw you were on a podcast, probably way more popular than this one, but this one will be way more
fun. We're gonna give up and just start taking pharma money because
we want pharma money. Give us the pharma money. We'll talk about you enough.
We'll talk about all of them. We won't be biased.
Yeah, well, come on, Amgen. We got Lilly. We got there's Viking that's out there. We got Metsera.
Boehringer Ingelheim coming up. Maybe some Pfizer, who knows?
Yeah. So, Pfizer's jumping into the game.
We won't discriminate.
Yeah. They just bought Metsera, right? And then there's Kylera. There's a bunch of other ones coming through. We'll take all of it. All right. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.